Welcome to Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. I'm Karen Freeman, and today I'm chatting with Professor Neil Coulson about online peer support communities. Neil is a professor of health psychology within the School of Medicine at the University of Nottingham. He's a chartered psychologist with the British Psychology Society and a registered health psychologist with the Health and Care Professions Council. And Neil has spent over two decades researching cyber psychology. His research interests include, but are not limited to, the role of online peer support communities in the self-management of long-term conditions, the application of psychological theory to health and well-being, and just so excited to have you on board. So Neil, before we get chatting about the work you do, can you tell me a little bit more about who you are, what you do, and what that pivot point was that sent you down the road of cyber psychology?
Thinking back, gosh, it'd be over 20 years, I was an academic, you know, a lecturer teaching psychology to a range of health professions, nurses, midwives, etc. But with a sort of side interest, obviously, in research. And at that point, I was interested in food-related risks. I was doing my PhD during the time of the mad cow crisis, BSE. So it was very sort of timely. So I was just plodding along as a usual academic, teaching, researching, juggling admin. And then I guess the pivot point was a curveball in life. And curveballs, we'll probably come back to them, tend to shape quite a lot of what I do in the directions that I go in. So years ago, and the irony around food-related risks you'll hear about in a second, but I was quite poorly for a while and lost a lot of weight. I was incredibly thin, about 5 stone I lost. I was in bed. I had no idea what was going on off work, you know, feeling very, very sorry for myself. And like many people, I started to search online. I couldn't make sense of what was happening and I didn't understand. And I was really worried I was actually going to meet my maker, as it were. So I started to sort of search online, you know, the pre-Google days, and I didn't really find any answers, but what I did find changed everything. And I actually stumbled across very sort of primitive discussion forums where people were discussing elements of their health, trying to make sense of it. And whilst it didn't actually align to what I was going through personally and at a symptom level, it really caught my attention. So to cut a long story short, I recovered. I'm obviously here today, and everything was fine. And it turned out to be an extremely nasty bout of food poisoning that triggered a huge psychological reaction that actually took 4 years to recover from. So, you know, it really shaped my life and shaped my experience of illness, but it also shaped my research interests. So once I felt well enough, I went back to work, and I was just fascinated by this idea that people whom you'd never met, you were sharing really quite personal, often quite detailed symptoms, experiences, fears, hopes, but you've never met these people. And this was just, you know, this was sort of 2003. So, you know, life is very different digitally then. And this completely blew my mind. So I got back to work and I started this search for literature and only found about one paper actually. But I was so gripped by this phenomenon, this going online, searching for information, sharing with peers, that I literally got a black bin liner. And I took my shelf of all my research, I slid it along, put it into the bin liner, put it in the bin, and started again. And I completely changed my research interests. Everything I was doing was putting that black bin liner, tied up, and that was the end of that. And I decided there and then that I really had to find out more about what was going on, because this just, as I said, it blew my mind. So I started to search. I started to really realize that there was very, very little. Certainly in the UK, this online peer support hadn't really emerged as any type of scientific curiosity that I could see. And there was the odd one or two papers that had come out of North America about people living with disabilities who'd gone online for support. So it was a blank canvas. There was many questions, and that was the pivot point that it all changed. So I'll kind of sort of pause there, but that's what led me to sort of personal experience in a completely different pathway.
Wow, that is quite a dramatic shift in terms of just dumping all your previous research and starting again from scratch. That's extraordinary. But I guess with life-changing situations, you get really curious about why and what is going on and how did this really happen?
Yeah, absolutely. And what really struck me to start with is the fact that people were clearly sharing very, very detailed illness narratives. So, you know, often quite embarrassing, you know, symptoms. You know, you can imagine the food poisoning, the range of symptoms that come from that. But people were discussing this, and I just couldn't get my head around why you would share such intimate details with people you've never met. And I had not seen that before. You know, it was pre-Facebook. There was nothing like this. So I was really interested to start with and just trying to understand what is it that's going on in terms of what people are sort of saying. And it became quite obvious, and you don't have to be a psychologist, but you can see that people were trying to help each other. They were trying to help themselves. They were trying to help each other. And there was clearly some type of reciprocity taking place in these online communities. So I guess as it all sort of started, I was really interested in how people were sort of seeking help, support, social support, how they were offering it. And again, you know, from a sort of psychology background, I trained as a health psychologist. So immediately social support is a concept that comes to mind, as well as things like stress appraisal and coping, dealing with stressful events. So your traditional theories you start to draw upon. And so I was really interested to start with, for a good few years, the sort of solicitation of social support. You know, how do people ask for support? But more specifically, what support are they asking for? And what are they getting? And early on, I was very much mindful of my own illness experience, but I didn't necessarily want to start off with, well, as it turned out, it was food poisoning, so it wasn't really anything that long term. So I had to make a decision as to, well, where do I start? What condition do I start to look at? Because as I Googled or searched online, I could tell quite quickly that there was these forums for lots of different health conditions, lots of different long-term conditions. And I was interested in that sort of longer-term health aspect, you know, the traditional chronic illnesses. But, and this is a really, really important but, at that point in time, there was no ethics guidelines for any of this. The BPS, the British Psychological Society, hadn't published anything yet. So there was nothing to hang your sort of research curiosity on that made you feel secure in what you were doing. And that, you know, reflecting back, really changed some of those early decisions, because I was really quite worried that somehow I would have a misstep. I would do something so ethically outrageous, you know, that people would hunt me down and tar and feather me because I had broken some rules that had never actually been written down. So that drove early decisions. And the way that that kind of manifested itself was the very first study that I wanted to do to look at the types of support which is exchanged. We deliberately chose a forum which had closed down, but which was still viewable. And it was a Huntington's disease forum that was no longer active, but it had access to it. And we felt that perhaps that was safer because we were so fearful of going in, being slightly voyeuristic, analysing messages. Would this upset people? We didn't know really what to make of it all. So by having a forum that you could still see what had been posted but was no longer active, all the data effectively is from, you know, years leading up to that point, we felt was at that point perhaps a safer option. So the very first study then started to look at Huntington's disease, and And I remember, again, we were really quite naive. We had not really discovered software packages. So we started coding messages. And it was, I think, 1,313 messages at that point in time that we started to analyze by hand, just looking for the presence or absence of social support. And that was the sort of the first sort of team-based study that we published. I'd done a smaller study on irritable bowel syndrome, but that relates more to the personal, you know, concerns at the time. But I remember distinctly making that ethics choice to go down that sort of route of a retrospective analysis. And so we started to explore the types of support that were exchanged. And you know, quite quickly, we could start to see a story emerging from that, because when you start to analyze the messages, and assuming you have a clear coding framework, you can start to see that things like informational support and emotional support are really jumping out at you, and you tend to see that as being the sort of more dominant forms of support. And that was interesting, because we, you know, we didn't really have anything at that point to hang it off. There wasn't really that much in the way of published papers. So that felt really quite new and exciting and interesting. But it was a starting point of a strand of research that I still do to this day, though often it's with MSc students, where we analyse the discussions that are taking place online, and we may still have a focus on social support. You know, what is it that people are actually asking for? What is it that they are exchanging? You know, that type of thing. It was a real sort of starting point into that world. Because at that point, everything was text-based, you know, so it was discussion forums, asynchronous discussion forums, was really the only thing that was available. So that's tended to dominate, again, much of my work, these text-based sort of forums.
Because that was, you mentioned in an initial chat, you started around 2003, which is pre-Facebook, pre-smartphones, pre all the kind of online social media kind of stuff. Has that changed in terms of how people use those support groups? Because obviously going from a text-based, more anonymous-based, asynchronistic communication to more of, here's my avatar, this is who I am, this is my social network, who kind of know me. Has that conversation changed, or are they separate groups? How have you see that shifted?
I think, you know, technology, smartphones is a great example. It's arguably changed the routes to support, you know, the vehicles through which you can get support. So when I started, it was probably people, you know, on their computers, the whole dial-up, waiting and logging online. But obviously, as things started to progress, and more people became digitally connected, more people had smart devices, support on the go became something that was more realistic. And we've seen that increase over time. You know, when you started with things like Facebook, that then also created opportunities for groups to come together around a shared experience, whether it be a hobby or illness or something like that. But I remember people telling us in online interviews that they were very concerned about anonymity, because, you know, the concern was that other friends in your network within Facebook would see which groups you'd joined. That doesn't really persist today. Things are much, you can divide your digital life a bit easier. But those were real concerns, because people didn't want necessarily people in their everyday network that they had a Facebook friendship with to know that they're also experiencing X, Y, or Z. And so there was quite a few concerns around that. And I remember many people telling us, we don't really use Facebook for sort of health-related social support. We'll tend to do it through the forums, because we can keep our sort of digital activities kind of separate. Now it's much easier. So I sense that there's less concern around that. And we've also got tools like, you know, WhatsApp. So that's changed the landscape as well. People can join online support groups that is effectively using the WhatsApp messaging system, but obviously you're then deluged with lots of messages if it's a large group, as well as things like Teams or Zoom and these types of more visual ways of communicating. That we've seen that arise You know, so particularly in the last sort of 5 to 10 years, has become an alternative sort of way to communicate. But it's still the text-based forum is the dominant way that online peer support plays out and still dominates much of what I do as a researcher.
You mentioned in the beginning that when there were more forums, when you first started out, people got really graphic about their conditions and what happens. Have you found that with it being slightly less anonymous and having things like WhatsApp and Zoom that people are less graphic about how they describe it, or is it just still they want that element of support so they'll more than happy be graphic?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's still an element of being graphic. And being graphic could just simply being detailed about the symptoms you're experiencing or the emotions that you're experiencing and the issues that you're having. So when you tend to look at those narratives, whether they be in forums or messages, they can still share quite detailed scenarios. But part of it is also what particular conditions you are looking at anyway. Some conditions, there may be more to say about symptoms as opposed to other types of conditions. So there is an element of, you know, what symptoms you're experiencing. But, you know, 2 decades later, looking at maybe 30, 40 different long-term conditions, you can now see the similarities across conditions. And there are huge similarities in the way in which people communicate online and how they go about getting support and the types of support that they seek and receive. You know, we can take that look back now and go, right, yeah, there is an element of consistency. There's obviously some nuance because not every condition is the same, but there is that sort of storytelling that happens in that first post or first introduction. If you're, you know, doing it through Zoom, you know, you share your story and then you take it from there. So there is some sort of familiarity and there is still an element of being detailed or graphic. I think with the asynchronous text-based forums, you know, you're not seeing people. So for some, they tell us that they feel more comfortable about sharing that graphic detail because they feel anonymous. In the more visual, the Zoom groups, the Teams groups, they're not anonymous per se because they are seen. But obviously what you might know about each other is much more limited, but there's still that feeling of less anonymity, and whilst you might share the story, it can be slightly abbreviated, I would imagine, until you feel comfortable. So I think, you know, they, looking back and reflecting, the text base, you tend to go in with the details straight off. With the more visual, you might go in with some detail and then it might unfold a little bit more over time as you feel comfortable because you're seeing people, and that's a different experience to just textually communicating with people.
You were talking about kind of the benefits, some of the benefits that people get. Can you talk about two sides of it? The one is what kind of benefits they get from it. So in joining while they're engaging it, and how does it benefit their condition? And the opposite side of that is kind of what the risks are and what kind of harms they feel being part of these communities.
So in terms of the benefits, I think it's a really good question. And that's a question that is being asked as we speak, because we don't have the strength of evidence to say definitively these are the benefits that you will get, partly because the sort of more gold standard evidence, the randomized controlled trials, just don't exist. There is very, very little. So to answer that question, you're inevitably looking at other methodologies to try and explore that. But I'm a great believer that if somebody says to you, this helped me for this reason, then that is fine. It helped them for that reason. So looking at these sort of more qualitative interviews, looking at the responses to surveys, and also looking at the content of the messages shared, we can get more of a handle on a whole array of psychosocial benefits that somebody might experience as they journey into and engage with an online peer support platform. So one of the most immediate benefits that we see and we're told about and we can witness is the feeling of I'm not alone anymore. And often long-term conditions, particularly those that are stigmatized, rare, or there's perhaps a lot of uncertainty, you can feel quite isolated. You know, patients tell us, individuals living with these long-term conditions, that they feel alone, isolated, they don't know others in their social network with that condition. So feeling of loneliness can often go hand in hand with the illness journey. But simply switching on and starting to read immediately signals to an individual, ah, there's somebody else that's got something like me. I'm not the only one. And so we see that coming out time and time and time again. I do not feel alone anymore, or as alone as I once did. And coupled with that, you can often see individuals write or tell us that they feel a bit more normal. They don't feel, you know, I remember doing a study about dental anxiety and dental phobia, and people saying, I don't feel a freak anymore because I can see other people are just as petrified of the dentist as I am. I felt abnormal, ashamed, embarrassed. I don't feel that. So reduced feelings of isolation, greater sense of normality in what you're going through. And then we tend to see benefits around optimism, around hope, around improved knowledge and improved management skills, coupled with that, more adaptive coping skills, knowing how to do something a bit better because you've read about it online from people just like you, through to perhaps greater confidence in talking about the condition with people in your immediate network, as well as healthcare providers. So one of the things I've been interested in over the years is being a member of an online peer support community going to impact the quality of your healthcare, because perhaps you feel more empowered to ask the right questions because you've had the opportunity to discuss it online. And we see that. We see that, you know, for some, being able to go to their GP armed with something to discuss or something that's been rehearsed can really bring benefit and confidence. So there's a whole range of these sorts of psychosocial benefits. Where we start to become a little unstuck and less clear is, does being a member of an online community change the clinical symptoms of your condition? And that's a much, much bigger question that we don't really know the answer to, unless those symptoms are perhaps to do with mental health. So we can measure depression scores, anxiety scores, but the more kind of physiological, biological, clinical indicators, we don't really have an answer to. So there's still a lot that we don't know.
But, sorry, Neil, that's almost like in some ways in medical research, they have the placebo effect. It's very difficult to measure exactly what difference the placebo effect actually makes. And I'm assuming that's a similar thing. There's an element of a psychological placebo in being part of these communities that's really tricky to nail down, because I guess patients don't really know what impact psychological benefits would be.
No, absolutely.
In terms of the recovery.
You know, our job as psychologists is to try and unpack and understand what it is that they're experiencing. And, you know, we could speak to a patient, they tell us about the experiences, and we are then translating that into our language, go, well, this is clearly this happening, that's happening. And so the language I'm using around loneliness, hope, adaptive coping strategies is my language as a sort of psychologist. But it's still quite a challenging question to fully answer around the benefits. And that was also partly shaped by, you know, the different theories that we might draw into answering that. So, for example, one theory and sort of framework I've been interested in over the years is around empowerment. So if you look at that from an empowerment perspective, you find the answer of yes, people who are part of these communities tend to report feeling more empowered. If you look at it in a different way, you can answer that question with different language and different theoretical constructs. So overall, I think there is a reasonable body of evidence of a breadth of psychosocial benefits that exist regardless of condition that's drawn you into these platforms. But when you flip it into the other side, the risks, I think this is a more challenging question to answer. And I think, you know, I'm still on a journey. I don't know all the answers. I don't know anybody who does. But I get the sense that there is a little bit more variability in the risks that might be present, because some of the conditions, for example, mental health, might have a greater exposure to people talking about suicide or self-harm. Would you get that if people were talking about, you know, some less problematic condition? Probably not. So I think it does matter what condition you're looking at to answer the question about risk. And I remember when I first started to explore this years ago, and again, there was very little written about this, but when I started to uncover literature around risks, it was all very much the main risks around online peer support communities are it's addictive, you'll lose all your friends because you're always online, and it's all just complete rubbish that you'll read. And so it was very basic and quite blunt warnings about the internet being, you know, this awful space. And it just hasn't played out like that, to be fair. There are elements and flavors of those initial concerns that have played out, but it's not as blunt as you will lose all your friends, you will do this, you will do that. So some of the risks that do exist, it's not the case that everything you read online in an online peer support community is utter rubbish. That's not the case. It's not the case for a number of reasons. For example, it could be expertly moderated, so anything of that nature is stripped out. Peers are also very good at correction and going, nope, that's wrong. So it's less of a problem. But it doesn't mean to say that it is applicable to each person who's reading that piece of health advice. So, for example, you know, there's many conditions where it might not be a treatment regime that is right for you, but somebody describing what they're going through, it could still be right for them, and it's medically, it's correct. It's just not applicable. And so I think for the risks, it's a little bit more nuanced. And over the years, I've been concerned about how people can really understand that what they read might have worked for somebody else, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's right for them. And I think that's been exacerbated somewhat by the fact that many of these forums are text-based. So you think you're very similar to somebody because of what they've textually described. That perceived similarity can be something that's really quite powerful. So when you read, oh, they're like me, they did this, that helped, oh, I must try that too. So you can sort of see logically how people could think, yeah, I'll try that because that person is just like me, they've gone through what I've gone through, and maybe that would work for me. And maybe it would, but maybe it wouldn't. But perceived similarity, I think, is what's playing out there. With the more visual, you know, you can start to maybe pick differences, similarities. But the fundamental concern I've always had is that just because somebody has shared a treatment or a drug treatment for them that's worked doesn't mean to say it's applicable to all. And one of the risks is that you start to bypass traditional healthcare and you make decisions based on things that have been said by people you've never met, or you might have met, but you don't know their medical history and you're not a medical practitioner. So it's always about trying to use these together, traditional healthcare, i.e. GP, healthcare professionals, alongside these communities and discussing what's been found and making sure that any treatment decisions are right for you. So that's one of the concerns that I've had, and I guess you could label as a risk, that people might act in ways that it's not necessarily right for them. The other sort of risk, I guess, or harm, which I think can extend across many different conditions,
again reflects the nature of the text-based communication. These communities are, by definition, repositories of hardship, of challenge, of problems, of pain, of suffering, uncertainty, of fear, anxiety. Therefore, it can quite easily become quite an overwhelming place. So if you think of the scenario, Joe Bloggs, Jane Bloggs comes in, ambiguous symptoms, lots of concern, reads something, oh my goodness, surgery? I didn't realize I might need surgery. Oh my word. And the anxiety levels go through the roof. So sometimes there is a risk of perhaps seeing what could happen further down the road that you knew nothing about, and or reading about how much suffering people are going through, and you think, oh, is this what my life is going to be like? This is awful. This is absolutely awful. So we've seen that come out quite a lot in our qualitative interviews, where people say that it can be really hard to just read about suffering all the time. And particularly when, you know, you're trying to look positively at the future, but your own journey may be quite challenging.
Do you think that's also potentially true for those who haven't yet had a diagnosis or feel that the diagnosis is probably not quite right? Yeah. And I'm asking this just from the perspective of I had health issues that I was misdiagnosed about five times, and I kept on going back and doing searches and going, but no, those symptoms aren't, that it doesn't make sense what you diagnosed me, it doesn't match my symptoms. And I think in some ways I can relate to that, because there's things going, is that my life? I don't want to deal with this. Am I going to die? And there were moments of just, oh, flip, is this really true? And then, but I think, and what I also really like about what you said is that there is an element of empowerment and going back to the GP and saying, I've read this, I've read that, I'm not sure. And I guess in some ways I had a bit of pushback from the GP kind of going, well, stop reading online, but actually I'm curious. I want to know, I want to be empowered. And also part of that, I kind of came across a term of cyberchondria, of people getting, you know, kind of getting really scared and kind of getting a bit too anxious about health by Googling and by reading online. You've obviously come across the term cyberchondria. Do you think this is a real issue? Or was it just a word that we've thrown around?
Just said, actually, that really resonates. I'll come on to the cyberchondria element, but I think your example of pre-diagnosis and the search for diagnosis really resonates. We published some papers on endometriosis, which historically has a very long timeline to get an accurate diagnosis. And so I remember in terms of interviews and surveys, you know, women saying, I'm just, you know, at the end of my tether with this. But the online support community was helpful in trying to unpack symptoms to then try and get that diagnosis and push, because there's a lot of struggle there. So as you were talking, it just reminded me of the endometriosis journey, which is incredibly challenging. So I think, you know, for people pre-diagnosis, it can help because it can motivate, you can learn, get skills, knowledge, confidence to try and get that diagnosis. But then post-diagnostic support is obviously very important across many health conditions, but sometimes those conditions are, you know, that it's not going to improve. So, you know, for example, I work a lot in dementia now, so that's really challenging because you want support, but you're also going to read that, you know, this is not going to end well.
But isn't there also an element of, especially with things like dementia or Parkinson's, when there are brain conditions that are long term and there is not really anywhere back? I'm assuming there's an element of family and friends and the support community around that person, that these online groups can be really helpful in terms of what I do next. How do I deal with this? What happens when? What do I look out for? What can I do?
Yeah, and we see, you know, so I think that's a really useful point to interject, that these spaces are not just for the individual with the condition themselves, they're for the people around them too. And so often in our studies, and certainly in dementia, many people who are within these spaces, these online peer support communities, are carers who are trying to navigate, learn about, you know, the social care services, how they can maintain their own well-being, how to spot developing symptoms, strategies to try and help the loved one, you know, with, you know, everyday tasks,
the whole experience can be really helpful for people to learn from others. This, I tried this with my husband, my wife, that might help you in the situation. You know, even swapping things like recipes, we've seen has been incredibly powerful and a useful way, not least because often people are confined to their own home when they're in the dementia scenario because they're full-time carers. So we've seen it being incredibly powerful in that respect. So it's a real sort of, you know, balance between sources of hope and inspiration and knowledge and caring and sharing, coupled with the harsh realities that often go hand in hand with many long-term conditions. These spaces can be, you know, difficult to sort of navigate. But I think, you know, just picking up on that sort of final point about the sort of cyber conjurer, I remember many years ago, I used that term cyber conjurer, or Dr. Google will see you now, and it got a little bit of press attention. And whenever researchers mention things like that, press tends to pick up on it. And I think, you know, more broadly now, we have quite a well-developed literature around health information seeking online. Many people do it. Google has become incredibly powerful. Now we've got AI, you know, going on to ChatGPT to try and search for and understand symptoms. So there's roots to that. But where I think cyberchondria specifically has relevance is, I would argue, it's quite normal to search for answers. You know, years ago, I remember when I was training in psychology, we were taught about the lay referral system. Put simply, you know, if you have a symptom, you might speak to your partner. Do you think you should go to the doctor? What do you think this is? With the internet, that lay referral system just became a little bit more expanded. And it's just expanded even further to now all these of the AI, you know, styles of trying to search for answers. But where I think the problem is where individuals with kind of low to moderate levels of anxiety are searching for symptoms, and then that perpetuates that anxiety. And then you start to see really quite elevated levels of anxiety, and it moves into the chondria, you know, the hypochondria, the cyberchondria. So I would argue that for most people, searching is probably a reasonable activity that they may have done. But the term cyberchondria is moving into a smaller population where that activity can actually perpetuate some mental health challenge that actually needs a little bit more sort of support. You know, people who are hypochondriacs generally are living with that elevated level of anxiety around health anyway. So again, it's that fine line between healthy searching and searching which might actually cause some harm, but it's not the case that it applies to everybody. There's other background factors going on.
So if someone wants to join or start a support group, we'll chat about joining one in a minute, but if you want to start a good support group, how do you start one? How do you implement it? Are the advice you have for scaling up or rolling it out? Because not, there might be some people who actually can't find a support group that really meets their needs. They might be diverse or whatever. So how do they go about starting one and getting it going?
So I think one of the easiest ways that I've seen people start an online support group is through things like Facebook and using those types of pre-existing apps, or starting threads and things like Reddit, or X or things like that, you know. So by putting something out there into this sort of digital landscape with a hashtag, then other people can connect to that. But I think what's important is choosing the platform. And often to the average person who might think, there is nothing, I need to start something, they immediately then start to think about Facebook as a vehicle. And that's absolutely fine. There are many sort of smaller online support groups that are Facebook based, or they could, because we now live in a world where we have Zoom and Teams and Jitsi and all sorts of these platforms, sadly not Skype any longer, but if one can find others like you through posting social media messages, then in theory you could say, let's have a meeting and let's do it that way. And I've seen some examples of that too. So those are the kind of the smaller initiatives. by finding others for online meetings or something around hashtags, or, you know, just finding people and agreeing to swap a telephone number for a WhatsApp group in itself is an online peer support group. So there are lots of ways that can play out. Where I think it becomes more challenging is when we're trying to get that high volume, bigger numbers. And, you know, I was mindful of a study years ago where we were looking at the creation of an asynchronous text-based forum for individuals with complex regional pain syndrome. And so we created this forum. And what became really apparent is that for these types of forums to sustain, you need volume of activity and you need volume in terms of membership. And that became quite an obvious point of our learning when activity collapsed because it just wasn't enough. So when you're starting, I think what it tells me is when you're starting off these communities, you have to think about what is going to sustain the community. Because if it is a text-based forum, will people use it sufficiently often to sustain that level of engagement? It might be easier to have that monthly or fortnightly Zoom group, you know, the last Thursday of the month, let's all drop in at 10 o'clock for a cuppa and a chat, and that might be easier to sustain. But the challenge of sustaining these larger text-based communities is considerable, and it does rest on the volume of activity, the moderators. And so I think it was probably about 2017, 2018, we published a paper in the Journal of Medical Internet Research that was actually a multidisciplinary team effort to try and unpack this. And using methods that I'm not expert in, the take-home message was that within these communities, for about every 1,000 members, you needed a sort of super user, somebody who was doing a lot of work. And if you took that, what we're doing, if you removed that from the community, we could demonstrate the community would collapse. So what it tells us is it's not so much about the numbers. I'm not saying you need, you know, for every 1,000 people, you need one, you know, super user, but you need high activity individuals who will be the glue, the bond, the conduits between people, saying hello, welcoming, you know, connecting people together. We call them super users. Don't know if that's the best term, but that's the term we see in the literature. They are the high volume users who've been there for a while. They know what's going on. And they are crucial. They're absolutely crucial because they can help the community flourish. They can assist the moderators who have very clear roles. And these super users can be really active agents for good and help sustain these communities when we're in these larger numbers. And some of these larger numbers, when you look at platforms like Health Unlocked, which is, you know, arguably one of the largest providers of asynchronous text-based online peer support, you know, we're talking tens of thousands of people registered in these communities. So you need these super users, you need these moderators to sustain that. And that's a real challenge. The other sort of final point to this, and it's by no means a full answer, I would say, is that you have to bear in mind that people go into these communities for quite different reasons. So I might go in because I have a very specific question and I need a bit of information. I get that information. Will I stay in the community? Maybe, maybe not. If I am living with a long-term condition and I might have informational needs, but I actually also have quite emotional support needs, I'm feeling very alone, very stressed out, really anxious, I'm likely to stay longer because that's more of an ongoing journey. So sometimes we have to bear in mind that some people can go in and come out quite quickly, and that is fine. Others will go in and stay longer, and it's partly to do with what needs they are bringing to the table. So we can, you know, we can see that sort of variation, and we can see variation also in some people like to post a lot of messages. Other people like to, you know, sit and just observe and read and soak it all in, and that's fine too. So there's a lot of variability. And all of that needs to be managed, and taken into consideration when we try to implement strategies to build larger communities that sustain and more people go to them over time. And it's a bit like a snowball, you know, as it, you know, rolls, it gathers, it gets bigger, you know, more people know about it, they join, they refer, they hear about it, there's more web presence, and it becomes a bigger vehicle. But the flip side is you also need the moderators, you need the people to welcome them, you need the super users to make sure there is activity, there's warmth, there's welcome, all these things work well. So there's lots of bits that have to be in place, I would think, to make a good community sustainable.
There's two things I was thinking of while you're saying that. The one is that I was kind of reminded of offline groups, like, and I'm going to use a random one, like the Rotary, that you need super users. You need people who are, and I think the Rotary is a volunteer group, that you need those people in that space who are kind of super users that organize and welcome people and get people in and keep them coming. And there'll be people that sit to the back and some people that'll be engaged. So in some ways, it's just kind of normal group, I'm assuming normal group behavior. It's just moved from an offline space into an online space. And the second thing is that a size of a group doesn't mean that it's more successful. You can have a group of three people and still be maintaining and the support that you need. And the reason I'm saying that is I've got a group of there's three of us that have been meeting for 3 years every week for half an hour to talk through kind of our health condition, and we're in a similar space, but we see ourselves as successful. We've never met in person, but because we've got this joint interest and need to find information, and we each do our own level of search and share it in a similar way. We kind of do this has worked for me. You might want to try it, but if you don't think it's fine, that's fine. This is where I'm at. And it's just really the support group that keeps going. So it doesn't have to be huge to be successful.
Absolutely. And completely agree. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but I completely agree. It's the quality and not necessarily the quantity. But for some of these national providers, national charities, you know, the quantity is quite high, but it's the quality, and quality of interaction can be supported by these dedicated super users who, you're absolutely right, are volunteers who have typically experienced a condition or the condition of a loved one, and they're still a member, but they've also transitioned into being a sort of helper as well. Helping self and helping others tends to be what these super users are doing. They've gone through and they're giving back. And maybe they're still living with and experiencing the health challenge themselves or somebody they care for. Or perhaps that story has closed out, for example, dementia, the loved one's no longer with us, but they're giving back. And they are absolutely crucial. But it is about the quality, and it's about that activity. And I think you're right. You know, these are attributes of what good groups work well, when people get on and we recognize the individual variety of people that might come into a group, the shy person, the slightly louder person, the introvert, the extrovert. You know, none of that's new, but in these digital spaces, we just need to remind ourselves that there is this variation. And if it's a text-based group, how would we know if somebody's a bit shy? How would we know? What can we do to just try and, you know, welcome people? Maybe somebody joins, you know, there's alerts. The welcomers go, welcome. If you need any advice to get started, let me know. But I hope you find this space really positive. That in itself can be really helpful. So I think it's not about these spaces are different. There's not different dynamics. It's the same dynamics. It's just been operationalized in a slightly different way. It would be my take on it, to be fair.
So, Neil, what is the most important question I haven't asked you yet?
Where's it all going next, I guess?
So where is it going next? What do you see? How do you see the future of kind of online support groups?
So I do get this question fairly regularly. And one of the things that I'm always keen to emphasize, because as academics, we can be a little bit territorial. This is my patch, keep off. And I just don't buy into that. So there is plenty room for everyone who has an interest to do something in this space, because a lot needs to be done. So I like to, first of all, say, ugh, to all the, you know, this is my patch, this is my, no. That's just rubbish in my view. So where it needs to go is, I think it needs to be multidisciplinary perspectives. When I started this, it was N of one, me, and then some PhD students, some MSc students, some colleagues. And one of the things you quickly learn, if you're only trained to look through a certain lens, you will only ever see life through that lens. And it became very apparent that I don't know the answers, but nor do I even have the language or the knowledge to answer these questions fully. So I think where it needs to go is we need to devote much, much more attention to building multidisciplinary teams that include cyber psychologists, health psychologists, whatever it may be, to try and unpack and explore what is going on in these online spaces and what differences that might make to the individual. But beyond that, what we really need to get a handle on, assuming we can generate evidence of efficacy, is we need to work with the people who can make this happen in the healthcare pathways. You know, we've seen, you know, for example, in recent years, we've seen, you know, the talking therapies, often a long waiting list, but, you know, years ago, you're feeling a bit down, have a pill. Now talk about it, great. But you can talk about it in a number of ways. Maybe talking about it in online peer support groups could be the answer for some people. But to get policies, to get resource to sit behind these types of healthcare interventions, you need evidence, you need those teams, you also need the connections at all the different levels to actually get it implemented into healthcare. And so where I think we're at right now is we're seeing a greater recognition of the potential of online peer support communities as part of a suite of healthcare options a GP, for example, could offer. But we need to do more to get the evidence, to educate healthcare professionals, to get, you know, commissioners to buy those services. You know, there's more. We're in that zone right now is where I would argue we're sitting and where we need to be. So multidisciplinary, large-scale trials, we're starting, but we're also needing to do more in evidence synthesis. So we have lots of researchers globally, each coming at it from slightly different disciplinary areas, maybe with slightly different language, in slightly different journals. We need that global sucking in and hoovering of good quality evidence to see what's actually out there. So in the last couple of years, I've been doing much more in terms of my own personal training in evidence synthesis, for example, training with the JBI in Adelaide to do good quality synthesis of a very disparate body of literature. It's not just me as a psychologist or cyber psychologist or health psychologist. There's people all over doing work in this space. So that's a really, really important strand as well. So it's the large scale trials with multidisciplinary teams, taking the breadth of that global evidence and drawing that into meaningful insights that can then be commissioned and rolled out and integrated into healthcare pathways is where I think we're at. And that's a, you know, a huge step from, a, you know, 20 years ago, going, what is this? You know, somebody's talking about this and never seen this before. So you can, you know, appreciate that, the journey.
Do you think that there's quite a lot of work to do in terms of getting healthcare professionals, so doctors and nurses and those even therapists who deal with people who kind of working through the psychological side of physical ailments, long-term illnesses? Do you think there's something around trying to get them on board and saying it's not just about medication, there's more than that, and these are different things that places you can go look at. And I'm asking that from the perspective, I wonder if there's quite a lot of medical professionals who kind of go, well, medication's the way forward and you shouldn't be asking people who are not qualified. So don't go down that route. Just come talk to me because I'm the one who's a professional. Do you think there's an element of them becoming more open to online support from that perspective?
I mean, I think, you know, that's a question, again, I've reflected on over the years. And I think, you know, looking back, we've seen divergence of opinion from that's great. You know, you're active, you're trying to find out about your health, to I am the expert, do not challenge me, and everything in between. But I think we've seen a shift towards more active involvement in one's own healthcare, trying to draw that forward and push that and see that as a good thing. I think healthcare professionals, including GPs, but broadly speaking, are becoming more knowledgeable and aware of the potential. I think there's a number of reasons why people may or may not have views about online peer support communities as an option. But I think if we can start to generate that evidence and translate that into things which we can demonstrate, if you were to refer patients, for example, who are awaiting a talking therapy, there's maybe a 6-month waiting list, but in the interim, we have an effective, a cost-effective digital tool where they can start that journey and it has demonstrable benefits. I think, you know, our healthcare professionals would welcome that. They want tools to help people. And
you'd think they would.
And I'm optimistic, but yeah, there's also, you know, there's variation in the beliefs that people have about technology. And that's shifting over time as, you know, sort of more digital natives become health professionals, you know, that, you know, they see the synergy between the two. So I think things are shifting. I think they'll continue to shift. There'll always be variation. But I think, you know, when we're talking about purely money, finding cost-effective interventions that could be rolled out to the masses, that will get a lot of people's attention. So I think there's lots of considerations that make me think that will probably help things move forward because of resource alone.
Yeah, but it's also kind of a holistic way of doing health, not just about medicalizing health, but just the whole person.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a place for everything. You know, when you go to a GP practice now, you know, there's nurses, there's physios, sometimes there's even dentists. You know, it's becoming a more holistic
approach to space.
Yes, absolutely. So this is hopefully, this will become part of the army, the psychological, the holistic element of healthcare as well. And it will all start to integrate even more seamlessly, I hope.
It's very exciting. It's very exciting news that, because it is about the whole person and getting them help a whole, because it, and I'm kind of going back to what you originally said in your introduction of actually there was quite a psychological basis to your illness that took 4 years to recover rather than 4 days. It was like, which is in my head, I was like, oh, it's 4 days. That's the time it takes to recover from food poisoning. But if there's implications, physical implications, psychological implications, that's a long process. So kind of getting that holistic approach is, and moving towards that is such good news because people will probably heal quicker.
Absolutely. And there are many conditions that have quite a strong, you know, psychosocial component to it, where, you know, this mind and body, they are interlinked, and, you know, what you're thinking can impact on the physical health. So I think we're just much better at recognizing that complex interplay between mind and body, and recognizing that we need to look after the entirety of a person. And in my particular instance, you know, yeah, there was a psychological element to that. There was a physical element. It all needed time. But during that time, support was needed to understand, you know, what's going on. And many individuals are searching for understanding. They're trying to find meaning in very ambiguous, very uncertain world. And, you know, this is a route to perhaps doing that.
So Neil, do you have any favorite psychology books or cyber psychology books or health psychology books that you could normally recommend to others to read if they are interested in this topic?
So I've probably got a range of things I'd say to that. So the first and foremost, the thing that I would recommend, because I didn't always have this, is the BPS guidelines for internet-mediated research. The fact that we're on the third iteration, I think is amazing. So I would always say, please, 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 if you're doing any research in the cyber world, whether it be online peer support communities or anything else, I think the fact that we even have these guidelines, to some you may not realize we didn't always have that. And that in itself is wonderful. But for me, you know, as a, I see myself in that kind of cusp between health and cyber psychology. I'm always struck by the work of other scholars from other disciplinary areas, because I learn so much from what they're saying, and they're exploring things similar to me, but in slightly different ways. And one book that I absolutely love is by a professor in America, a professor of communication, Stephen Raines, called Coping with Illness Digitally. And it's a really nice book because it encapsulates everything I've ever really been interested in: how we search for our information online, how we might use emails, how we might use blogs, how we might use these peer support communities online, and our whole experience of illness can be played out digitally now. And I just love that book because it just represents everything I've been interested in and everything I'm likely to be interested in going forward. And I also love the fact it's from a different disciplinary area. And so seeing somebody else's views and language or the things I'm interested in is really, really helpful.
Thank you for those. Neil, thank you so much for joining me on Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. It was so fabulous to catch up with you. And I look forward to chatting to you again in the future.